This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
This crisis should be a wake-up call that we need to decrease our dependency on fertilizer.
Trade and agriculture expert Timothy A. Wise says that the global food and fertilizer crises should be a wake-up call that fossil fuel-based agriculture is unsustainable and extremely vulnerable to supply chain disruption.
In the case of dock workers worldwide, we have the ability to stop working military cargo, and that's a leadership role that we've borne over time, and workers get on board with that.
Opposition to the funding of the war in Ukraine is growing in the labor movement.
We said free the land, clean the water, and make it public.
And in Jackson, Mississippi, Mayor Chukwe Anta Lumumba says that federal funding allocated to the city as part of the American Rescue Plan is not enough to address the city's water infrastructure crises. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt of KPFT Houston. UN World Food Program Chief David Beasley says that the world is facing drastic food shortages for several reasons, including a shortage of fossil fuel-based nitrogen fertilizers. Russia is the world's top exporter of nitrogen fertilizers and one of the top exporters of ammonia, an essential ingredient of nitrogen fertilizers, but the pipeline from its ammonia plant to the Black Sea is shut down because of the Ukraine war. Pacifica's Ann Garrison spoke to trade and agriculture expert Timothy A. Wise, senior advisor at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy.
And Timothy Wise, you've been warning for years that neither the fossil fuel industry nor fossil fuel-based agriculture that create these supply chain vulnerabilities should exist. Can you walk us through the process and the consequences of ammonia and then nitrogen fertilizer manufacture?
What happens in the production of ammonia generally is that most of it's produced from natural gas. Some is produced from coal, and it's produced through a chemical reaction at high pressure and high temperature that combines the hydrogen from the hydrocarbons of the natural gas or coal, and that pulls the nitrogen out of the air, so that you get ammonia being the product of that. And the ammonia is volatile, and so it's not a particularly stable compound to be moving around and using. So it is pretty quickly usually turned into synthetic nitrogen fertilizer through an additional process. And that fertilizer can take different forms, but nitrogen fertilizer, the majority of it is shipped and produced as urea, UREA, which is essentially a stable and more easily transported compound that is easier to ship, easier for farmers to spread on fields. Some is also converted to synthetic nitrogen fertilizer in blends, other fertilizers, and that's a very common product as well. So it's an entirely fossil fuel derived product. Literally, one of the components comes from fossil fuels, the hydrogen part, and very energy intensive because it's very capital intensive and energy intensive to produce it. It's overwhelmingly produced by developed countries with advanced industrial facilities, and then is often exported from those places that have natural gas, that have the resources and the capital to do it, to the rest of the world. And Africa is overwhelmingly an importer of fertilizers, and because of that is particularly vulnerable to these sorts of supply chain interruptions, which can take a lot of different forms. But in the current case, we're seeing a real serious confluence of those impacts with energy prices rising because of the Russia-Ukraine war, supply chains disrupted by COVID before the war and now by the war itself. And Russia and Ukraine are large suppliers of both food commodities, wheat in particular, that is exported to Africa, and fertilizer, which is exported to Africa. So the impacts on Africa are interrupted wheat supplies, high prices for wheat, and interrupted supplies of fertilizers and very high prices for fertilizer.
So it's ammonia that's exported through the pipeline, that goes from Russia to Black Sea ports, isn't it?
I believe that's right. And it's generally converted to fertilizer before it's exported.
So in whatever industries exist for this in Black Sea ports, are they Russian or Ukrainian, or do you know?
I don't know, but I would imagine both have very developed facilities for producing fertilizer.
Okay. And the ammonia pipeline, I imagine, is very volatile. You talked about how volatile ammonia is. And it's definitely what caused the port explosion in Beirut, right?
That's right. It can be very volatile depending on the form it's being stored in. And the original applications of this weren't for fertilizer, it was for explosives. That's how the first real boom in the production of ammonia.
That was in World War II, right?
Took place, was before World War II.
Okay. So once it's converted to nitrogen fertilizer, or urea, I mean, is urea also a type of nitrogen fertilizer?
It is. That's right.
Okay. Does it cease to be as volatile, or is it still a volatile substance?
Not in the sense that I think you and I mean volatile. It's not as stable as everyone would like to believe, in the sense that when it's applied, it breaks down. One of the breakdowns in all of this, when nitrogen fertilizer in any form is applied to fields, is serious emissions of greenhouse gases. It's different for urea and different from other forms of nitrogen fertilizer, but both emit significant amounts of greenhouse gases. When it's applied in the field, it breaks down. Nitrogen volatilizes, becomes nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide is nearly 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, and persists in the atmosphere for more than 100 years. So it's a really damaging output of nitrogen fertilizer used the way it is now. It's estimated that nitrogen fertilizer emissions account for about 10% of all agricultural emissions in greenhouse gases. So very significant.
Do you have any idea what percentage of greenhouse gases released into the atmosphere every year nitrogen fertilizer creates?
The estimates, I think, are around 3%.
Okay. So that's not quite as bad as it might be.
Well, I mean, let me just say, though, that's a...
It's not good. It's not good.
A lot of research has gone into being a little bit more accurate in identifying the life cycle, including production and field emissions. And the estimates have gone up significantly because it's such a potent gas, and because it's something that we have the ability to curtail. There are substitutes for synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. That and methane are two of the three big greenhouse gases that we have more control of scaling back than we do of carbon dioxide, which just takes a lot more retrofitting and systemic change to do. So people are really looking at methane and nitrogen as areas where we could make a big difference by 2030, which is what everybody says we really need to do.
Okay, I see you have a map of Africa in your background, and you have focused a lot of your research attention on Africa. As Bill Gates says, whether it's vaccines or fertilizer, can you tell us then, from the Baltic seaports, nitrogen fertilizers are shipped to Africa? Is that what happens?
That's right. About 80% of fertilizer in Africa is imported. Most countries import fertilizer because Africa doesn't have the developed infrastructure or the developed natural gas resources. They are trying to develop those natural gas resources now, in part to make more of their own fertilizer, but that obviously has climate implications too.
Yeah. So then once it reaches Africa, is it used by individual farms, industrial farms? Does it become a state subsidized product?
Well, all of the above to different degrees. What the Gates Foundation and other donors and many African governments have said is that Africa needs to be using fertilizer at a much more intensive rate to be competitive and to grow enough food. Bill Gates himself, in his climate change book called Nitrogen Fertilizer Magical, Mr. Science is resorting to magic. But he basically says in that book, he implies that there's no way to grow food without it. There's no way to grow enough food without it. And so Africa, which has the lowest average rates of fertilizer application in the world, very low by global standards, needs to dramatically increase that by tripling it by 2050, or in some scenarios, increasing it 800% as a way to catch up in its agricultural production. And there's just a lot that's wrong with that formulation.
So how much of this is state subsidized? And it's just wild guess, how much of it is?
Well, there's a lot of, I mean, there are a lot of countries that have what are called input subsidy programs, which came in alongside the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, which was founded in 2006 by the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, and other donors. And the entire purpose of those initiatives is to try to increase the use of commercial seeds and synthetic fertilizers in African agriculture. And many governments will provide very generous subsidies, three quarters of the cost, giving out coupons to farmers to go redeem them for commercial seeds and synthetic fertilizer. And that's been the main strategy to try to get farmers to adopt and use these fertilizers. It really hasn't worked, which is one of the interesting parts of the story that I've covered a lot. Those kind of subsidies, you've gotten a lot of farmers using, still a minority, but a significant increase in the number of farmers using these so-called modern inputs. They haven't produced the kind of yields and incomes that would allow farmers to keep buying them, which is the whole idea. The whole strategy is get farmers hooked on these things, get them to see that it's economically profitable for them. They then have money to invest in more food, more economic development, and more fertilizer, and they can keep increasing their productivity. None of that's happened. So it's been a failure on its own terms. And in that sense, as soon as the subsidies go away, the farmers often just drop it. It's a waste of money. It just doesn't work.
They haven't made enough money using these.
Right. To keep using them.
Okay.
No, and often they've gone into debt. In fact, they find themselves in debt from it. And then they face all kinds of terrible choices. So one of the great myths of the fertilizer crisis, as it's called, for Africa, is that Africa can't grow food. Africa is going to have a famine if we don't get fertilizer to the farmers now.
Yeah. Let me jump in. That's what David Beasley said in a video that's going around. He said 50% of the food in the world is grown with nitrogen fertilizer, and there's a big shortage because of the Ukraine war, and particularly because Russia was the top exporter of synthetic fertilizer, and this pipeline is shut down. So he said there's going to be massive famine. What's your response to that?
Well, there's an element of truth to all of those warnings, which is that there are risks of famine in parts of Africa, particularly in parts of East Africa and the Horn. And it's also true that farmers who are dependent on fertilizer and commercial seeds are really in a bad place because they either can't get those things or they cost too much. And so they can't buy as much, they can't use as much. And their yields, you pull a farm that's addicted to fertilizer off of it, you'll see big drops in production. So the short-term impact is indeed negative. Unfortunately, the response of people like the head of the African Development Bank is to open up a $1.5 billion fertilizer facility to provide credit and support for farmers and governments to be able to buy more fertilizer, even at these high prices, just to keep the train rolling. And I think what African farm organizations are saying is, no, this crisis should be a wake-up call that we need to decrease our dependency. Sure, we have a short-term crisis. Yes, fine, get some fertilizer to farmers that need it. But the warning sign is telling you to start decreasing your dependency on fertilizer. And Africa in general, under donor direction, is moving in the opposite direction. The Gates Foundation, the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, is saying Africans need to use more and more fertilizer. And farm groups are saying, no, if climate change is telling us anything, if the fertilizer crisis is telling us anything, it's we need to reduce our dependence on external inputs, on fossil fuel-based inputs, and increase our reliance on local resources to produce our food, and we can do it. And that's the other part of the story, is they can do it. They've shown there's a lot of ways to fertilize the soil better than nitrogen fertilizer does.
Okay, so you've got three primary problems. One is the environmental problem, another is the supply chain vulnerability, and the third is that it's ultimately not that productive and it damages the soil.
That's right.
Yeah. So what do you say when David Beasley says, yeah, but we've got this emergency right now. People are about to starve. Let's hurry, hurry, hurry. We've got to get the fertilizers, the synthetic fertilizers here. What would you propose in this situation?
I think what he's trying to respond to, well, I mean, fertilizers are basically for the next cropping year, not for right now. Fertilizers do not solve an immediate problem. They solve a problem after the next harvest by boosting the next harvest. In a lot of countries, this last harvest is done and people need food. So the World Food Program is doing some heroic work trying to rally food donations. It works much better than it used to. It doesn't just take U.S. surplus grain and dump it on developing countries. They buy more regionally and locally in markets where their production is still good. And they mostly do it with cash. So that actually helps developing economies instead of hurting them sometimes. So absolutely, we need to get food to people who are on the edge of starvation. But I would love to see a commitment on the part of the World Food Program and others. And there is some new attention to it, but a real commitment to saying we need to transition farmers away from this dependence on these external inputs. And the COVID crisis was telling them the same thing. We need short supply chains, not long ones. We need local resources and local markets developed, regional markets developed, not international ones. The multinational firms that dominate the fertilizer industry do not want to hear that. And they're really driving the bus right now, which is unfortunate.
That was Timothy A. Wise, Senior Advisor at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy and author of Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable. Vegetables cart off and sell my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable. Oh, table vegetable. I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right out. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so
This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Last week, Brazil held a presidential election that has garnered much attention around the world. The two candidates were Jair Bolsonaro, a retired military officer, and Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, the leader of the Workers' Party. Lula won the election, but not by a large enough margin to avoid a second round, which will take place on October 30th. Fabio Bosco is a transit worker and member of CANLUTAS, an independent labor federation. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zelter about the danger posed by Bolsonaro and the growth of a fascist movement.
We had national elections last Sunday, and the background is exactly what you described. It's a combination of an economic crisis. The pandemic left the Brazilian working class in a very difficult situation because high unemployment and the new jobs emerging, let's say, very low quality jobs. So today, the official figures show that 33 million Brazilians do not have enough food to eat every day. So it's a tragedy. And this tragedy always brings a kind of discredit on the traditional political parties. You know, Steve, the ones that have been ruling the country for the last 30, 40 years with liberal policies that attack the workers' rights, the working class living conditions. And so there is a lot of discredit. And this situation altogether is bringing a kind of polarization, you see. On the one side, the far right occupies the space of the traditional bourgeois right-wing parties, and they build a basis. And it's a basis, a very problematic basis, because they put together, for instance, sections of the capitalists that are destroying the Amazon. I mean, loggers, mining industry, agribusiness. And together with them, they have a section in the army with generals, among the policemen, the police forces, ultra-conservative Christians, even the militias. It's a kind of mafia that there is in Rio de Janeiro in the poor areas. These all together become a basis, you see, for this far-right unity around our president Bolsonaro. And on the other side of the polarization, in the case of Brazil, we have a reformist, social democrat, a candidate Lula da Silva, that has been the most important working class leader Brazil has ever had, but he changed completely his politics 30 years ago. And he made an alliance with capitalists and the right-wing politicians. You see, his candidate for vice president is the former governor of São Paulo, who is a right-wing bourgeois politician. So he built this alliance, and there is a huge polarization in Brazil. At this moment, probably Lula will win the elections, probably, because he just need 1.5% votes more to win in the runoff, which will be held on October the 30th. But Bolsonaro and his group, let's say, they will remain. They may lose the elections, but they are strong enough. They built themselves in the last 4 years, and they are a threat for the working class. Just to say something else, Steve, that I think it's important. Lula administration will be also an enemy of the working class. So they will carry out reforms against labor rights, against social rights, for sure. And we will have to fight back. On the other side, we will have to develop self-defense against these Bolsonaro groups, because they may be an alternative for the capitalists to attack the working class and prevent the working class from uniting and standing up.
And maybe you can talk about, you know, the role of the unions, because CUT, the Union Federation, is supporting Lula. And as you say, that the fascist and the forces around Bolsonaro are not going to go away. Even if they lose the election, they're going to step up the attack, and maybe terrorist attacks on unions, on working class communities, on immigrants, on indigenous people in Brazil. So it seems like it's a massive intensification, whatever happens in the election.
Yes, you are definitely right. The point is that the majority of the labor movement, they are supporting Lula. And unfortunately, they have a very good excuse to remain supporting Lula administration, if Lula wins, of course, because they will always point to the far right and say, look, we must keep this government to stop the far right. But the government will not do anything to stop the far right. Why? Because for the capitalists, at this moment, Steve, the capitalists prefer an administration like Lula, because he can play a kind of preemptive role in stopping the working class struggles, you see? But just in case he cannot control these struggles, then the capitalists, they have a second card, you see, which are these far right groups that are organized. They are scattered across the nation. And if the capitalists need I'm sure they will hire these guys to attack the working class. So I see that on the one side, of course, it's important to defeat Bolsonaro in the elections now. But the working class must know that Lula administration will be the one in charge of taking our rights away. We'll have to challenge the new administration. And at the same time, we'll have to prepare ourselves. The unions will have to prepare self-defense tactics in order to stop the far right.
And when you talk about self-defense tactics, what does that mean? Because in the United States, the unions, the AFL-CIO, prevented a resolution even being discussed on the issue of a general strike against an attempted coup and insurrection. And the leadership of the AFL-CIO have said that the main way that we're going to fight fascism is to elect the Democrats. That's what's going to solve and defend the working class. How do you see organizing in the working class in Brazil to defend workers and communities under attack by fascists and right-wingers?
You see, Steve, the self-defense has many different aspects. The first one is to prepare the poor neighborhoods or the unions, you see, prepare them for any kind of action that comes from the far right. It means, first of all, to develop all means we can develop in order to carry out this self-defense. There is some kind of training for self-defense, but essentially groups, you see, we need to have groups that specialize themselves in protecting the demonstrations, protecting the picket lines, protecting the poor communities, because otherwise we'll be an easy prey for the far right. Now, how it will develop, there are some experiences in Brazil, particularly among the homeless people. When they occupy a land, they prepare, they guard the area, you see. People, volunteers, they make one entrance, people all the time in this entrance, in controlling who is in, who is out. This is one aspect of self-defense. When an occupation of homeless people in São José dos Campos, the police wanted to take them away, there was a kind of military training among volunteers in order to stop the police from taking them away. So there are some experience, but they are not enough. We have to develop much more. And I feel that the working class has an instinct as a class. And when they are under attack, they will carry out these tasks related to self-defense very quickly and deeply.
That was Fabio Bosco of the Trade Union Federation Conlutas speaking with Pacifica Steve Zeltzer about the presidential elections in Brazil.
Bolsominions são demônios que saíram do inferninho direto pro culto pra brincar de amigo oculto com Satã no condomínio. Bolsominions são vergonhas que bastavam distraídas, burrice modesta, o horror à festa e a risada instruída. A bolsa de valores tem valores, os corpos malhados sem alma, o sangue de barato e a raiva de toda humanidade que não quer ser salva. A bolsa de valores tem valores, os corpos malhados sem alma, o sangue de barato e a raiva de toda humanidade que não quer ser salva.
That was Chico Cesar singing Bolsa Minions. We now go to the water crises in Jackson, Mississippi. Jackson's main water treatment plant malfunctioned in late August after torrential rain caused flooding along the Pearl River. The influx altered the quality of the raw water entering the plant from a reservoir. That slowed down the treatment process and depleted supplies in water tanks, subsequently causing a drastic drop in pressure. City leaders have said that some pumps failed prior to the rainfall. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves announced that the state-imposed boil water notice has been lifted in Mississippi's capital city after nearly 7 weeks during a Thursday, September 15, 2022 news conference in Jackson, Mississippi. He also said the water is now safe to drink. A week after the announcement, Davey D. of Hard Knock Radio spoke to Kali Okono of Corporation Jackson. Here's a part of their conversation.
Let's talk about what's happening as an update, you know, where we started off at and where we're at now.
Well, let me say what they are claiming. They are claiming as of last Friday that the water is drinkable. That is what, you know, the city, county, state governments are saying. They are starting to dismantle the water distribution centers that the state agency set up. The community effort is still ongoing because the community is anticipating, number one, that the crisis is going to continue. Number two, you know, not many people truly believe that the situation has been resolved, that the system has been fixed, that the filtration, you know, replacement, two pieces that they used to replace at the D.B. Cooper facility are adequate to sustain the system. And in my view, there has been a tremendous rush to just kind of patch up the system and move on. And that just leaves us subject to the treachery of the boil water notices that we've been living with for decades now, but, you know, at a much more accelerated pace since 2020. This is where we're at right now.
What is the boil water notices for people who don't know?
The boil water notices are issued from the city and or the county when the city and or county, but in this case, primarily the city, cannot guarantee the quality of the water because it has not been filtered adequately enough and or it has been contaminated by one of the pipes that has burst and has, you know, got some minerals or wastewater that has leached into it and is being delivered at various homes and businesses and offices and facilities throughout the cities. And so they're saying, hey, because we cannot guarantee that it was filtered properly on our end, we are recommending to you, before you drink it, before you use it to cook, or before you use it to bathe, that you boil it to make sure that you can kill any bacterium, right, or any other kind of contaminant that may be in the water. That is what these boil waters are. And before this crisis, the city would have virtually a boil water notice in one or another neighborhood for years. Now, the entire city had that for well over 40 days, right? And then intermittently, basically, since June. But the entire city, not just a section, because typically it's a little section or a little neighborhood, but the entire city has lived with this basically throughout the summer and now into the fall. And I just want to, you know, state again that to fix the system in Jackson, it is going to take billions of dollars. Billions. They have not allocated billions of dollars to do anything in the last month, right? They have just done a patchwork on a failing, inadequate system, which is going to fail again within the next couple of days, next couple of weeks, next couple of months for sure. And we will be right back where we were throughout the month of September. But I wager this time around, it will not garner the national and international media attention that it just did.
We see the situation in Jackson where you're at. The water is undrinkable. It requires a solution of innovativeness at this point in time if we don't get money. Mm-hmm. Do we have to now start very intentionally all hands on deck, you know, and really put our shoulder to the grind and start to become innovative, where we start to have these conversations, we share resources, we bring our intellect, our creativity, our skill sets, and start to craft these solutions on our own, because it's obvious that the game plan is to let us, you know, fall to pieces, and ain't nobody going to pick it up except us. So do we now have to start putting weight on those type of solutions now?
Well, let me back up just a bit, David. This is somewhat tied to this narrative that Black folks and brown folks cannot govern ourselves or govern, period. That's still a narrative today. That narrative ain't going nowhere.
Right.
That's the narrative, basically, that Tate Reeves, Governor Tate Reeves, and the Republican, you know, supermajority legislature are still peddling around Chokwe Antar Lumumba's administration right now.
Wow.
And it's the narrative which they are using to prop up one of two solutions that they are advancing. There's the solution, as far as they're concerned, that they want to push for, that to either privatize Jackson's water system under their control, not Jackson's control, or regionalize the system, right? Have the surrounding counties, basically, and I want folks to look it up, it's either Madison County or Rankin County, that are right adjacent to the east and the north of Jackson, Mississippi, which are both majority white, like that they would be the ones who would take over, not only in providing some resources. Jackson would still provide the lion's share under any kind of agreement that they craft, but they would give them probably the majority votes and deciding power to those two particular counties, because it fits into this narrative that Black folks can't govern themselves. Now, how is this connected? You asked the question, you framed the question like, do we need to start doing alternative things? We have always done alternative things.
Right.
We have always done it from day one, right? Because the situation requires it and has long required it. The issue is, will the alternatives we create be allowed to exist? Right? Will they deem them illegal and then destroy them? Or will they then do what they commonly do or historically have done, particularly the last, you know, 50 or 60 years, declare it illegal for certain people to engage in those activities, but then create a market avenue for certain other people to benefit from innovations that they didn't innovate, right? But because they have access to capital and because they have political friends, you know, in high office, a cousin, a relative, an uncle, right, their father, you know, get their part passed while, you know, the more low-grade do-it-yourself varieties that we innovate wind up being deemed illegal or not up to code. So I'm bringing it up because we people are already coming up with alternative ways.
Right.
But the ways which people can do for themselves are fundamentally deemed to be illegal.
That was Kali Okono of Corporation Jackson speaking to David D., host of Hard Knock Radio. Mayor Chukwe Antar Lumumba spoke to Roland Martin, producer and host of the online news platform Roland Martin Unfiltered. He said that the water crises in Jackson predates Black leadership and that federal funding allocated to the city as part of the American Rescue Plan is not enough to address the city's water infrastructure.
Whether we agreed on everything, I have to give them credit where it is due. Tony Yarber, who was immediately before me, lifted up issues with the water. My father lifted up issues with the water and our need to address this. I'm sure Mayor Frank Melton, who's no longer with us, did as well. but I have been able to confirm that Mayor Harvey Johnson has done it, right? And it even predates Black leadership. It goes to a point where our city has begun to turn the corner of what the demographic represents. And so those are the things that we need our people to understand and know. And so my fear is this, is that when our people are going through the most trauma, we don't want them to reach for a solution that actually puts them in a worse position than where they are. We've said free the land, clean the water, and make it public. We have to explain to people why it has to be made public. Because first and foremost, when you privatize the water, companies aren't coming in order to run that and invest in it because they have some benevolent purpose, right? They're trying to get a profit. And the only way that they can make that profit is to raise the price on poor people who already have affordability challenges. Why don't we want the state to run it, right? Well, when we're talking about these issues of equity, when we're talking about these issues of not getting our fair share, then why would we trust the state to run it? Furthermore, the state doesn't have the capacity themselves because they don't have the personnel necessary to run Jackson's water treatment facility, which is probably the most complicated in the country, but certainly the most complicated and complex in the state of Mississippi, right? So they're looking to get a third-party operations and maintenance group that they would contract out to work to operate and fill in those gaps. Jackson was already in a discussion about an operations and maintenance group that we could contract, not privatize, but contract that out. So if they're in the same discussions with the same company that we're in, then their purpose is not for it to function correctly because they recognize the same company that we recognize. Their purpose is to capture the revenue. Thirdly, the last option that they have put out is the option of regionalizing, saying that you need more ratepayers on the system in order to maintain it. Well, on the surface, it makes sense. But when you think about it in a little more critically, it entirely breaks down. So when Jackson was larger, of course you had more ratepayers that could support the system and maintain it. As people moved out, that became a challenge. As we look at a regionalization model, what you have to understand is that when you bring in those other cities, yeah, you have more people that are paying to the system, but they depend on water in order to maintain their services, the revenue from water in order to maintain their services, just like Jackson does. And so you expand the perimeter of your responsibility. Now you have to take care of their pipes. Now you have to take care of their ditches. Now you have to take care of all of their infrastructure problems. And you're under a regionalized system where you have to believe that they're going to prioritize Jackson over these cities and communities that they continuously don't prioritize us over, that they don't give us our equitable share. And so I want to lift up right now, if I could ask the Poor People's Campaign to do anything right now, is to lift up these facts, to understand the history of this struggle, and to understand what is taking place. The lieutenant governor met more than 3 years ago with a concession firm about my water system, right? About how he could maybe enter into an agreement where they would pay money to take over the system and that they would be able to take the profit. Why is the lieutenant governor having a meeting 3 years ago about Jackson's water system? Why aren't they meeting with the leadership for us to control that and to talk about what we felt was in our best interest? I'm hearing from state legislators who are passing those same narratives. We have people who are willing to push us into a special session with the legislature just so that they could take over Jackson's water system. These are the things that have to be lifted up. These are the things that our people are crying out about.
That was Mayor Chokwe Antar Lumumba, 53rd mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, elected in 2017. He is also an attorney.
And these lies, they be killing us. Forced to flounder on a small supply. Lead water, they've been dealing us. Hapless choices dying to survive. And the government be billing us. Truths that they conceal from us. Truthful surface in the tide. I said stand up. Good water is a human right. I said stand up. It's time. Katrina, 2005. Black and brown bodies waiting in the water, ungodly sight. Where is FEMA?
Was Flint by Aisha Fukushima. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Although the AFL-CIO and most unions in the United States are supporting the U.S. proxy war with Russia in Ukraine, opposition is growing within the labor movement. Pacifica spoke with former International Longshore and Warehouse Union President Brian McWilliams about why working people and organized labor should oppose the war.
We have never supported any wars in this way. That clearly the only victim are working people and families. And this war, if you could call it a war, it's a capitalist action. And the resolution for this war is not one that's going to really bring peace. I don't see how the conflict between the West and the East is going to get resolved here. It's just a continuation of the same thing that's gone on since the end of World War II, where we've just continued to encourage and spread profiteering that war brings along with it. We've been involved in wars in the whole time, my whole life, we've been involved in wars, and wars are profitable. People can make a lot of money. The corporate entities can do really well in wars, and working people pay the price. And that we would support one side or another in this situation is really against all of our own best interests. And I don't know how this could have happened. Anyway, I'm not a representative anymore of the union. I just have an opinion. And I don't speak for the union. I'm a retired person. I just was upset that collective wisdom of the delegates in the convention wasn't followed through with.
And the ILWU's history has been, as you say, against war. There was a West Coast strike against the war in Iraq. But the ILWU has had a long tradition of opposing militarization, opposing war. What has happened that position has changed? Because it seems that as you say, that there wasn't any debate or discussion among the rank and file of the ILWU about whether there should be a change in the position.
I can't speak to that. I haven't been very involved in the inner workings of the union for quite a while now. So I've left that to the elected officials that we collectively, our working membership has chosen. And I'm disappointed that there's a disconnect between our philosophy and our marching orders, if you will, from the delegates that develop all our policies to what's actually being presented to the public or to the world. It's really a departure from anything that we've done in the pretty much, not entirely, because these things are happening more and more, but it's disturbing.
So the military-industrial complex, the war profiteers, this militarization and all the weapons that are going to...
Well, we can't take care of our domestic home issues. We're spending more money. People are going to work every day to support this issue. We have by far the biggest military in the world. Our Air Force is the biggest Air Force in the world. And the second biggest Air Force in the world, besides the United States Air Force, is the United States Navy's Air Force. And you know, there are incredible investments being made in perpetuating the war machine and our dominance worldwide. We have bases all over the world. We're exerting our military. It's not the road to peace. It might be the road to military domination where people aren't actually shooting at each other in some way, but it has nothing to do with peace. And people, if they live in fear of anything, of freedom of expression, freedom of association, whatever freedoms we have, if those are in jeopardy, people can't live in peace. They live in fear of whatever issue has been deprived through this military might and exertion of power and force.
I mean, the ILWU was involved in the formation of the Labor Party, Alliance for a Labor Party, and the idea that the union should have their own political party. It didn't work out. That organization was not able to go forward. Do you see the same needs for working people in the United States?
Well, of course. Workers should have their own political party. I mean, the bosses have two. Why shouldn't we have one?
And the unions provide millions and millions of dollars to the Democrats, mostly. That's what most of their effort is taken up in, elections for the Democrats. Do you think the Democrats are going to save working people in this country?
They've been terribly disappointing. They haven't done it yet, so I don't see any reason why I should think they would in the future.
And what can working people do? I mean, I think that the action by the ILWU International in supporting the war in Ukraine, the United States, is not unique. Many other unions in the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, SEIU, have taken similar positions. How do you see that changing at this point in the United States?
Well, I don't know. In the case of dock workers worldwide, we have the ability to stop working military cargo, and that's a leadership role that we've borne over time, and workers get on board with that. I mean, the leadership is sometimes not in touch with their memberships, and that's what really needs to happen. The democratic trade union movement really needs to prevail, and how to support that, how to make it more organic is really a huge challenge for us.
Do you see a revitalization of labor? There hasn't been, in our lifetime, a mass workers movement, in fact, that formed the ILWU. There was a mass workers movement at that time that led to the general strike and a mass mobilization of the working class. That hasn't happened since the 40s, 46, the last general strike in Oakland. There hasn't been that kind of mass mobilization. You think it's coming?
Well, I've been described as a pathological optimist by experts. So I can only believe that there has to be some hope that it will come.
That was former ILWU International President Brian McWilliams speaking to Pacifica Steve Zelter about the Ukraine war. This coming weekend, rallies are planned in over 60 cities in opposition to the war and the danger that it will go nuclear. For more information, see the website of the United National Anti-War Coalition at unacpeace.org. That's unacpeace.org. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. CRD's executive producers, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer, produced this show with help from Pacifica's Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.